from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The new U.S. Attorney General, Loretta Lynch, went to Baltimore Tuesday to take a firsthand look at the situation there.
People have thanked me for coming. Let me say that the honor is really mine, because when the city is in turmoil and literally pain, as you have described, to watch people come together and be as determined as the city of Baltimore has been to reclaim the city, to rebuild the city, and to make it, again, the great city that it has always been, has been inspiring for me.
In our special report today, we hear the perspective of a leading professor of African American history as he looks through the lens of class and racial politics through the context in which the events in Baltimore and elsewhere in the country have developed. Dr. Gerald Horn currently holds the John Jay and Rebecca Moore's Chair of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He received a PhD from Columbia University and a JD from the University of California, Berkeley. He's a frequent contributor to Political Affairs magazine and specializes in the workers' struggles against imperialism, colonialism, fascism, and racism. Dr. Horn spoke with CPR's Bernard White via telephone from Houston Tuesday.
We've been watching here very closely what is transpiring in Baltimore. Loretta Lynch is going down to Baltimore today to talk to community and religious leaders and some other officials about what's going on. I know that you've been also watching the developments in Baltimore, and how do you assess what has been happening?
Well, first of all, let me approach it from 30,000 feet and then come down to the ground. What I mean is that in order to understand not only the tragic events in Baltimore, but in Staten Island and Cleveland and North Charleston and Ferguson and all of these other sites of bloodiness, you have to step back and look at the big picture of the United States of America. And you have to understand that this country was founded as a result of a revolt in 1776 that was a revolt against Britain moving towards the abolition of slavery. Needless to say, the Africans did not go along with that revolt, which is something that historians have sought to obscure, obfuscate ever since. And as a result, a culture was created that tends to see Africans, particularly men of African descent, as enemies of the state. Now, on the one hand, the creation of the United States of America revealed or was a step forward insofar as it was revolt against religious conflict in Europe. That is to say, the Protestant versus Catholic divide that has riven Great Britain for centuries now. And of course, not only Protestants versus Catholics, but then Christians versus Jewish and Christians versus Muslim and all the rest. The United States revolted against that, at least in the formal sense, as embodied in the First Amendment, which called for freedom of religion, which was a step forward for the late 18th century. But what's left out is that they replaced that religious axis of society with the racial axis of society. That is to say, those who are defined as white versus those who are not defined as white. And that's what we've been struggling against ever since. Now, what happened in the 20th century was that a class project arose, which attempted to inject class as the major axis of society. But most of your audience, I'm sure, lived through the period when the class axis and the class project has suffered debilitating blows, not only with regard to unions domestically, but with regard to socialist projects globally. And so, therefore, it's no accident that we see a revival and resurgence of religious conflict abroad, such as the rise of ISIS, the Islamic State, and, of course, what's going on in Syria, Boko Haram, Al-Shabaab in Somalia, etc. But also the revival of the racial question, because the class project is not there to help to civilize the United States of America in a way it had been civilized for decades. And so, therefore, you have these police killings, and until and unless what I just said is grasped sufficiently, And the black community in particular begins to realize that we need to turn to our friends in the international community to save us from a slow-motion genocide. Until that realization is grasped, I think we'll always be living through these tragedies from day to day and week to week.
We do have one organization right here in New York City, the December 12th Movement, that has been trying to, has been going internationally, particularly to The Hague, to try and present this issue to the world community.
That is correct, and I'm quite familiar with the brothers and sisters in that movement, and they've been doing yeoman service and yeoman duty, but it seems to me that particular trajectory has to be broadened. I mean, if you look at the Black Lives Matter movement, that has also been a positive development. But we not only need to have this global thrust, we need to have a kind of organization that we used to have in the past. That is to say, organizations that had memberships and membership cards and dues-paying members and national congresses and national conventions. And we've lost that in recent decades, not least because of the pulverizing attacks on such organizations, which has left us in this pitiful state. And this could not come at a more untimely moment, because not only are we under attack in terms of our very lives, but also our very livelihoods are coming into question with the surge in robotization. In coming decades, robots are going to be doing many more jobs than they're doing today. And they're already doing that in certain factories, which is one of the reasons why you have a Baltimore where unemployment is so high, which leads many people to feel that in order to survive, they have to, quote, break the law, unquote, in order to get diapers and milk for the babies and all of the other life's necessities. And, of course, then that feeds into the so-called the prison-industrial complex, with our brothers and sisters being on a fast track into the prisons. As a matter of fact, when I think of Baltimore, I think of a series that appeared in the Baltimore Sun, the local newspaper, about a year or so ago, about this so-called gang that had significant influence in the Baltimore City prisons. And the leader of this so-called gang was quoted as saying, with regard to his ability to influence the guards and the prison administration, his quote was, quote, "This is my jail," unquote. And I thought about this, and I said, that's what it's come to. We are boasting about claiming ownership of the sites of incarceration that are strangling us. And I thought that that was both a revealing commentary, but a devastating commentary at the same time.
How do we begin to solve this? I mean, it's a very complex issue, trying to organize. How do we begin to try and bring that to some type of organizational structure?
Well, I think that the seeds are already there. One of the things that's heartening about Baltimore is that you have a very significant membership of 1199 SEIU, the Hospital Workers Union. You know that at one time Bethlehem Steel was a major employer in Baltimore, but now the major employer are the hospitals of Johns Hopkins University, which has thousands upon thousands of workers. And if you look at the signs that are appearing at the manifestations and the demonstrations in Baltimore, you'll see these signs with 1199 SEIU at the bottom. I think it would be quite worthwhile for some of our friends and leaders in 1199 SEIU to convene a congress or a conference that would have at its mission building an organization that focuses like a laser beam on police crimes, police misconduct, police brutality, all over the nation. And as noted, this organization would have dues-paying members, would have chapters from the Atlantic throughout, out into the Pacific to Hawaii. It would hold demonstrations on a regular basis. It would have petition drives on a regular basis. It would have an international outreach. And it would ultimately try to support, if not overtly, covertly, a candidate for political office who would take that their mandate into the halls of Congress, into the state assembly, into the state city councils. Because, of course, there are a number of significant reforms that we could push for right now that could have impact. For example, the training of police is really pitiful. They're not really trained for that long a time. And, of course, the whole broken windows theory, which has reached something of a zenith in New York, is in no small way responsible for the itchy trigger fingers of these police officers, which I connect directly not only to Bill Bratton, but to this culture of not training police sufficiently. Obviously, there needs to be a civilian complaint review board that would ride herd on police officers and immolate Marilyn Mosby, the prosecutor in Baltimore, and crack down on these officers once they commit various offenses. So I think that there are a number of reforms that could take place, but it seems to me it won't occur until and unless we deepen our level of organization.
You know, one of the problems that we also face is that we all experience the same phenomenon, but look at it differently. When I say look at it differently, I'm talking about the white community. And one of the reasons why it is looked at so differently by them is the role that media plays in interpreting these events. And their interpretation just takes us farther and farther away from the reality of what is actually happening. So one of the obstacles that we also have to face is a white community, for the most part, that becomes an obstacle to trying to bring this together.
Well, you are correct. There was a very interesting article in the journal called The National Interest, written by John Judis, J-U-D-I-S, who styles himself as something of a social democrat. And his conclusion was that all these protests against police brutality are actually alienating what he called the, quote, white, unquote, community. It reminds me of what President Barack Obama said just last fall after the November elections, when he said that when many in the, quote, white, unquote, community look at what's happening, they look at this kerfuffle over immigration, they look at the controversy about Ferguson and all the rest, and they think that it has nothing to do with them. As a matter of fact, they think that that shows that the state is paying more attention to those who are black and brown than those who are defined as white. In other words, they don't necessarily see us as their class brothers and sisters. Reference here my comments a moment ago to the decline of the class project domestically. But they see us as some kinds of racial others. And that's why, A, we need a recognition of that very salient point, and B, there needs to be some kind of ideological affirmative action with regard to the Euro-American working class and Euro-American middle class. That is to say that just as in the 1960s, you had students going into Mississippi to educate black people about the right to vote, as we were about to get the right to vote for the first time, we need to recognize that at this new stage, that if we don't take affirmative action ideologically with regard to some of this backwardness that too often afflicts our Euro-American brothers and sisters, well, then I think that the country, and not only the country, but ourselves, are going to continue to go down. And the problem is that it's very difficult to get people to acknowledge that basic fact. I mean, you can't talk about this sort of thing without some of our so-called progressive friends accusing us of engaging in identity politics, whatever that means. I still don't understand what that term means, but apparently it's intended as an insult and a put-down. But as they engage in these insults and put-downs, at the same time, the nation, not least because of this right-wing trend in the Euro-American community, the nation continues to drift to the right, which is very dangerous for us. But it's also very dangerous for them, too, ultimately.
You know, I was just thinking yesterday about Loretta Lynch going to Baltimore And right now we have a unique phenomenon for America, two black women who are very prominent in this whole discussion. And I'm just was wondering how the white community perceives that. Does that make it a black issue to them, as you were alluding to a little earlier? It's just, you know, everything just seems to be turned upside down. And I'm just wondering how they are perceiving that. Does that officially make it a black issue because you got these two prominent black women, or two black women that are prominent in the decision-making process?
Well, it's not only Prosecutor Marilyn Mosby, it's also the mayor of Baltimore, it's also Loretta Lynch, it's also, as I understand it, the head of the National Guard. And, of course, the National Guard just pulled out. But the sister whose name I can't recall was apparently leading that force. I can only speculate on how that's being perceived. So it's difficult for me to say. But I think the overriding problem, once again, is that people don't realize that the bell tolls for thee. That is to say, that just as at one time, teenage pregnancy used to be thought of as a, quote, black issue, unquote. And what folks didn't realize is that oftentimes, as the former mayor of Newark, New Jersey, Kenneth Gibson, used to say, that what happens to cities happens in Newark, New Jersey first. Well, oftentimes what happens in the United States happens to black people first, or black and brown people first, but not necessarily exclusively. I mean, that's the problem. And so as people, or at least some people, throw spitballs at the black community as a result of what happened in Baltimore or what's happening in Baltimore, they don't realize that the Grim Reaper is coming for them next. We're just the initial victims and the first victims. But once again, I have to keep connecting this to the decline of the class project and the fact that people, the class consciousness is not at a very high level in the United States of America for reasons that go back to the founding of this country in the late 18th century. And that, of course, allows these billionaires and hedge fund managers to run roughshod over the rest of us. And even when you have public servants like Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, a, quote, Democratic socialist who's now running for president, or at least trying to get the Democratic nod, or Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, as Juliette Malveaux, the former president of historically black Bennett College, pointed out recently, that these leading figures who try to talk about the class question oftentimes then lose sight of the race question for whatever reason. They don't speak out on questions of police brutality. Interestingly enough, Secretary Hillary Clinton, also contending for the Democratic nod, gave a speech in New York just a few days ago raising the question of, quote, mass incarceration of black people. Interestingly, former Governor Mitt Romney of Massachusetts castigated and denounced her for that, saying, what mass incarceration is she talking about? Shouldn't people be put in jail for committing crimes? And so Hillary Clinton, who is far from being a class warrior, at least has spoken out on this question, where those who try to style themselves as class warriors tend to go mute at the idea of speaking out on racist oppression. I mean, this is the conundrum in which we find ourselves. Mm.
You mentioned a very important point a little earlier about politicians, and this, whatever movement does emerge, has to begin to rein in its politicians. We have a political class right now in the black community that is pretty much invisible. You would think that they would be screaming out at this point about these police murders that are taking place, and they have been virtually silent.
Well, I mean, if you look at Congressman Elijah Cummings of Baltimore, he's been vocal and in the streets. If you look at Congresswoman Donna Edwards, who's from the Maryland suburbs of Washington, D.C., in fact, is trying to run for Congress, run for the U.S. Senate, she's also been rather vocal. But interestingly enough, Congresswoman Edwards is now under attack for not necessarily carrying water for the Israeli lobby. I think the problem is that the U.S. as a whole has moved so far to the right, and that if you look at these black politicians, many of them either don't wield that much power. I mean, if you look at the House of Representatives, there are 435 members, about 10% of whom are black, none of whom are the ruling party, almost all of whom are not in the ruling party. Mia Love of Utah, of course, is in the Republican Party. And as a result, are not holding committee chairmanships, which is where the power lies. Or even if you look at the mayor of Baltimore, Stephanie Blake Rawlings, who, of course, has made certain stumbles, which will probably lead to her being defeated in the next election and replaced by her predecessor, Sheila Dixon. What happened was that the governor, Governor Hogan, when he moved the National Guard in, he basically took power away from her and put it in his hands. That was basically the power shift that took place. And so, I mean, I think it's fair to criticize the black leaders, but I think it's also fair to suggest that they really don't have as much power and influence as you might suspect. And in any case, in this sea of the white right, it's very difficult for islands of progress to emerge.
But it does seem that one of the things that they do have, or potentially could have, is an informed constituency that would at least empower them to stay in office so that they could continue to speak out.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I don't know. We're in a very difficult situation in the United States of America. I mean, if you look at the Democratic Party, which is the party for which many black people cast their votes, the Democratic Party is not a political party in the old sense or even in the global sense, whereas people who vote Democrat are not necessarily dues-paying members of the Democratic Party. They don't necessarily belong to a Democratic Party club. That is to say, many political parties have clubs where people in neighborhoods or in work sites come together every couple of weeks to have a discussion and to plan action about the issues of the day. The Democratic Party doesn't work like that. And because the Democratic Party doesn't work like that, it's very difficult for any congressperson, no matter how well-intentioned, or any public servant, no matter how well-intentioned, to operate and to empower their constituents because the structure is not there. Now, of course, what could happen and what should happen is that for people who are going to vote Democrat, they should, obviously, if there's the next Democratic Party convention, be plotting to develop that kind of structure I just enunciated, or alternatively, they should be plotting to develop an alternative to the Democratic Party. If you see, as many do, Democratic Party basically being a party dominated by billionaires and multimillionaires. And so until those kinds of breakthroughs happen, once again, we're just going to be going down slow.
Now, the charges that Mosby has brought against these officers, do you see any weaknesses in the charges that have been brought? What do you perceive to be the outcome of that? I know that's a difficult question, but
it is a difficult question. But I think the major worry right now is a change of venue. That is to say, the attorneys for the defendants moving to take the case out of Baltimore on the premise that the community is too inflamed. Now, that will be their official line. The unofficial line, of course, is that they'll get black jurors who will try to make sure the justice is done. And then that motion might be successful, and then the question was where. I mean, I don't think they want to move the trial to Washington.
Simi Valley? Simi Valley?
Yeah, exactly. So that's a real question. Now, what is the level of evidence? I mean, there's a powerful circumstantial case in the sense that we see the deceased, Mr. Gray, being dragged into a van, and we know that after a ride in that van, somehow he emerges with his neck broken and his spine severed. Now, a reasonable inference is that something untoward happened in that van. Now, if I were the prosecutor, and I'm not sure if the prosecutor is going to do this, which you may want to try to flip some of these defendants. That is to say, to offer one of the defendants, maybe the black woman, Alicia Neal, I think her name is, I can't recall, and get her to testify against the others, or get the driver, who is a black American male, as I recall, to offer him a lesser sentence in order to testify against the other. And so I'm sure all of this is being debated, but it's unclear right now how this trial is going to come out, needless to say.
To me, it just seemed, well, the driver, I think his name is Goodard, it seems that most of the weight is being placed on him. And just looking at the pictures, and certainly I'm not a medical examiner, and I can't tell exactly what happened, but just looking at the limited amount of video that we did see, it seemed that that young man was in tremendous pain when he was being picked up and moved. His head was tilted to the side. That the majority of the infliction of his pain and suffering happened on the ground prior to moving into the van. Now, they did not strap him down in the van, but it seems that the major charges are being made against the driver as opposed to those police officers that apprehended him in the first place.
Well, as you know, there's been a lot of press coverage of the so-called rough ride. That is to say that oftentimes with intention and malice aforethought, drivers of these police vans do not put safety belts on presumed or alleged defendants who are being transported. And then they may handcuff them at the same time. And so the person who is handcuffed is almost like a rag doll being tossed around, particularly going through potholed streets, particularly as drivers are slowly suddenly stopping and swerving and all the rest. And so the person who's handcuffed was bouncing around like a pinball in a pinball machine. Now, that was the apparent theory of the case that I gleaned from press coverage, which is why the driver has gotten the heaviest charges. But as you suggest, perhaps that's a mistaken theory of the case. Jury selection is going to be key. Jury selection is going to be critical. Obviously, as already noted, the venue is going to be critical. That's to say, where this trial will take place, whether it'll take place in the city of Baltimore, Baltimore City, or whether it'll be moved out of Baltimore City. But I think the main thing, and this is what's heartening about Baltimore, is that there's been a steady drumbeat of protests. That is to say, people felt that the announcement of charges were important. And I should also add parenthetically that there's been an announcement of charges, but it still has to be an indictment, which should be a slam dunk. But you never know, in these sorts of things. I mean, you might get some sort of runaway to grand jury that decides that we all, as was once said in the city of New York, the state of New York, prosecutors and a grand jury can indict a ham sandwich. But we also know that in these cases involving white supremacy and racist oppression, that the normal rules oftentimes don't apply. So we shall see.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.